there's a moral element to being an artist. Not that you go out of your way to moralize, but that to make certain kinds of art, you have to be a certain kind of person. So sometimes I'm struck by pieces of art where I think, I can't even imagine being the person who was so morally sensitive that they could make that, that they could write that. So that's something that I'm aspiring to, is I want to be the kind of person who can make art that deals gently and graciously with these topics. And that means that's like a day-to-day practice, you know?
I'm talking today with Jane Clark Sharl, a poet, playwright, and critic. The concluding poem from her 2024 debut collection, Ponds, addresses the risk God takes in creating a world that can be almost mesmerizingly beautiful. A risk, Sharl writes, that entices us to look no further than the world itself, to misperceiving God through the radiance of what strikes our senses. We speak today about perceiving the divine by way of the natural world, about familial relationships, and about seeking signs of God's presence in a world that, while beautiful, sometimes resists granting those wishes. I'm Matthew Wickman of the BYU Faith and Imagination Institute. Jane, it's good to see you. Thanks for being on the podcast today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So we're talking about your 2024 poetry collection, Ponds. Now, if I'm not mistaken, this is the first collection you published, right, of poems?
Yeah. Yep, is it? Yeah.
Okay. But it's not the first book you published. You published the verse drama Sonne le Matin in 2023. Now,
yes.
Both books are written in verse. So I'll ask you this question first. Do you consider yourself primarily a poet, or are you primarily a dramatist, or are you an author who writes in several genres just accidentally in verse? I mean, how would you define yourself as a writer?
That's a good question. I think, first of all, I would say I'm just a writer. But if you push me to go more than that, I'd probably say I'm a dramatist first. And you'll see that even in the collection, the Ponds collection, I use the dramatic monologue form a lot, even throughout that. And I just love being able to speak in other voices and even find my own voice more in other people's voices. So I would say, first and foremost, I work in drama. Most of what I've written, I've got a really clear, almost stage picture of it in my mind. And so even little lyric poems, there's sort of a dramatic element to them.
There is, and I love that about them. And all the collections, actually, it's just a beautiful collection. Let me ask you about how you conceived of the collection. Did you imagine it when you were writing it, the poems in it, as a larger integrated whole, or was it like a bunch of one-offs you'd done here and there that slowly coalesced into something more unified?
That's a good question. I knew some of the themes once I started writing. I knew that this first collection was going to be about some themes of home, family, those kinds of things. I wrote them in several different places. So about half of them I wrote in Arizona right after I got married while I was still in graduate school. And then the other half I wrote in Colorado when I had young children and my mother was dying. So it was over a period of about 5-6 years, but there were two very different settings and different stages of life. So I think my conception of how the collection would hold together definitely grew over time. But I had a sense of what I was trying to do, what I was trying to get at. And I have almost a whole nother collection's worth of poems that are not in this because they just didn't quite fit that theme. So it was pretty clear to me what I wanted the collection to feel like.
Okay, all right. Do you plan to, those other poems, are those like, are they themselves coalescing into something new, or are they just really kind of just, there's not yet anything clear in what they're going to be yet?
It's not quite clear yet. There's definitely a little bit of a more political element to them. And I don't say that in a contemporary politics way, but in a studying human relations and studying how certain people govern themselves and govern others, and other people seem unable to govern themselves and to govern others. So a very classical definition of politics in there. I'm seeing that a lot. So I've got I'm working on a longer dramatic monologue about the Nika riots, which is where Emperor Justinian massacred 30,000 people, but also brought stability to the kingdom. So this fascinating moment in history where this man makes a staggering political decision that actually turns out really well for the rest of the people. So there's a lot more stuff like that. There's a little bit of that in Pons, actually in the title poem, because I'm very interested in politics. But I think this next collection is going to be even a little bit more like that.
Okay, that should be provocative.
And it should be fun, yeah.
Yeah, and it's a season of our kind of history where these kind of things are on many minds.
So, yeah, they are.
Yeah, so I'll keep an eye out for that.
Okay, good.
As anyone who listens to the podcast over the past four seasons knows, I love religious poetry, right? I love the ways it can attune us to what's sacred. It can sensitize us to the spirit of God. It can put us in touch with the depths, you know, the mystery, the wonder, et cetera, of creation. And this is not to say I don't enjoy poetry that isn't overtly religious, because of course I do. I write about it, I teach it, et cetera. But I love God, and I'm always grateful for art that brings me closer to God. And great religious poetry does just that. And your poems, your collection, Pons, does that for me. And so I'm grateful to you for that. And this is all a long-winded way of asking you this question. Given the religious themes and motifs in several of the poems in the collection, do you consider yourself a religious poet, or are you rather a poet who happens to be religious and whose religious life thus finds a place in your poetry?
Yeah, it's a good question. And honestly, before you asked it, I had never really considered whether I'm a religious poet or not. I'm a deeply religious person, and I think that religion gives us a lot more than just a structure on our passing lives. I think religion, and I'm Catholic, so particularly these hierarchical religions, they give us real insights into actual reality. So when I say I'm religious, it's more than just I do certain activities. I really do believe that religious structures teach us about reality, and they are, as we habituate ourselves to them, we're habituating ourselves to eternity. So we're teaching ourselves, this is how you will live in eternity. So I also think for me, what I'm trying to do as an artist is prepare myself for eternity. So the two paths are so closely connected. I think I would have to say I'm a religious poet. Hopefully that doesn't mean that people who aren't religious don't find anything in the poems. They're not all about God or religious ecstasy or religious structures or anything like that. They're really an attempt to understand reality and to look reality honestly in the face and then try to square what I see with what I believe, because so often there's a disconnect, you know, between when you're religious, you believe God is good, and then the world is full of pain. I mean, what do you do? What do you do? So that's really the key. And I hope that people who aren't explicitly religious would still be able to look at the poems and feel that longing of, oh, I feel like the world is good. I feel like the universe is good, and yet there's pain, whatever language they would attach to it. So I think I would have to say I'm a religious poet. Poetry and prayer are very closely connected for me, and they're basically the same spiritual movement.
Yeah, I love that answer. I really appreciate the nuance there. What is that? And this is a paraphrase, but isn't it W.H. Auden who said that poetry is the clear expression of complex feelings, or something like this?
I think so. Yeah.
Right. And in a lot of ways, I think that a genuinely reflective religious life is one rich way to come at the complexity of our experience. Because you're asked to reconcile things that otherwise are not easily reconciled. It's what's the meaning of this beautiful thing with a larger thing that you can't see that you believe helped create that thing? Or how do you reconcile good and evil? Or even one's own inclinations, right? To be good on the one hand, but where you have things that rile you and upset you on the other hand. So it's a way to actually bring some sense of focus to these contraries of our existence.
Yeah. I like that way of putting it.
Well, let's turn to some of these poems in this great collection, Ponds. In fact, the first poem, which is titled Reflection, seems important not just because it's first, but because it expresses an idea that's like a motif in the volume, which concerns the relationship between what we perceive and what eludes perception. It's not a lengthy poem. Would you read this poem for us, Reflection?
Sure. Yeah, Reflection. Leaves this morning are young moons, flashing with a glow that is not their own, tossing borrowed bits of color back to the visible world. Watching them, I wonder about all the other light, the unseen illuminations that slip too quick to be seen down through the skin of the world to its heart, where maybe there lie halls of long still rooms where things can rest and not reflect, and where I cannot go.
Okay, it's a lovely poem. All right.
Thank you.
I really love this poem. Thank you. I'd like to ask you about part of it, this evocation of, I'm reading it here, all the other light, the unseen illuminations that slip too quick to be seen down through the skin of the world to its heart. Okay, these unseen illuminations. You know, neuroscientists, psychologists, artists all talk about the elusive nature of perception, right? That what we actually behold is only a small fraction of things that might be perceived. In your poem here, there's an otherworldly, almost heavenly quality to those unseen illuminations, right? They reside in a distant place, which is you, right, where things can rest and not reflect, and where the poet says she cannot go. It's a great image. I'm wondering why you imagine this unseen place as a place of stillness and rest, rather than, say, a place of greater intensity of a kind we cannot yet endure, a place that God might endure, but we can't dwell there yet. Why stillness rather than ecstasy? Or for you, are those the same thing?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it gets back to the nature of God. And in the Judeo-Christian tradition, the nature of God, the Father, is this, at once, he is stillness. And he also is, he's the mover, you know, he's the unmoved mover. And so those two concepts of stirring and stillness are inextricably linked. And that, I love that mystery. And I think that's what I'm trying to get there. And when you think about heaven, you think about Dante's vision of heaven, it's this constant movement that is all around this still point in the center. And T.S. Eliot is obsessed with the still point. And the silent word that speaks, like all these things where things that don't seem to be able to exist together, in God they manage to. So that's what I'm really interested in, kind of in all these poems, really. But in that line, I'm just fascinated by the way that God is behind everything. And I remember I read a description of heaven or of the end of the world once. I don't remember who said it. It might have been a Jewish philosopher, but that he was saying something like, what if the end of the world isn't some sort of explosion from the outside in, but instead everything just expands out, and everything that's been contained, you know, within atoms and neurons and everything that's been like bunched up comes outward. And all of a sudden we see and experience everything. And I don't know scientifically if that works, but as an image, it's gorgeous. So that was definitely in my mind when I was working on this poem.
I love that. I love the tension there in the poem. And that image really is quite striking, you know, kind of this whole series of big bangs, you know?
Yeah. It's marvelous. It's really marvelous. And if you look at Candles, which is another poem in here, I think I return to that idea of stillness and stirring being kind of the same thing, like with the flame of the candle is constantly moving and is also stable in its own way. So it's definitely something that I'm very interested in. I haven't quite figured out, you know, my one and only way of saying it yet.
You know, I love it. That Yeah. That's a lengthy poem, or we would read that poem. Yes, that's a bit too long to read, but it's a beautiful poem. Yeah, but in 14 stanzas. A couple more things about this poem, but just reflection. Yeah. These qualities, are reflection, stillness, are these some of the things that drew you to the images of ponds, which refer in several of the collection's poems?
Yeah. Yeah, because you have a pond and it becomes this element of a landscape, and it sort of draws everything to itself. You know, you get a whole ecosystem, you get wildlife and trees, and rivers run into it and out of it, and it gives this sense of stability, but it's also this constantly shifting and changing thing ecologically. And then even if you just sit next to a pond and you watch the surface for 5 minutes, you can't believe, you get an impression of it as it's one color, it's flat. And then you spend time looking into it more deeply and you realize it's got so many colors within it. And that impression you had of flatness or stillness is completely wrong.
That's right.
But then you look at it again and it can go back to that wholeness, you know, that all the moving elements can become still again. So yeah, that's definitely where that main image comes from.
It's a great image, right? Because it's hard to imagine a churned up pond the way you can a churned up ocean. And yet if you look at the pond, it really is never actually the stillness of its own impression.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yep. It's a very dynamic thing. And you think to yourself, there are a lot of living things in there. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's great. Now, this is one more thing about this poem, Reflection. It's hard for listeners to envision this, but your poem gathers its images into three quatrains, right? Three four-line stanzas. They're unrhymed. So they don't like loudly beat the poem's images into shape, but there is nonetheless, for the eye at least, an organizing principle to the poem, right? These three four-line stanzas. I'm wondering if this is how you see poetry. Do you see poetry itself as a genre, as a form, gathering these otherwise unseen illuminations into forms that make them more discernible? Is that what poetry does? Or is it doing something different as you see it?
That's a lovely description of poetry, actually.
I take it from you. I borrow it from you.
I like it. Can you say it one more time?
Well, just the question of whether or not poetry gathers these unseen illuminations, as you describe them, into forms that make them more discernible for us.
Yeah, I think it does do that. And part of how it does that, the reason I'm really interested in verse, why I tend to write verse rather than prose, would be in poetry, the unsaid is so much more noticeable, partly because you just have the blank. You have blankness on the page, which always indicates, you know, an unspoken thing. And then within poetry, you have the breath. You have, there's kind of a question in poetry. Is the word or the silence that comes after the word, which of those is the central experience of the poem? Is it when you're actually actively listening, or is it when you've received the whole poem and you're going, at the end? And you can get that in really great prose, but in poetry, I think it's a more frequent element. So yeah, I think that's a beautiful description of what poetry does, is gather and curate these things that you, and sometimes you can't even do it in poetry, but you can at least indicate maybe, oh, there was one, it went that way.
That's right.
And get people at least to look at the trail that it left, you know?
Yeah, sure. Well, I think that's what these poems do, like really, in really elegant ways. In fact, let's turn to another poem if we can. This is, let me ask you about the poem here that I think speaks to what I take to be another motif, actually, in the collection. That motif is the poet's relationship with her mother. I say the poet's with hers and not you with yours, because you point out there are these dramatic monologues, and there's something clearly that hits home here for you. But how much is you and how much is character? I'd ask you about. This poem is titled Salt. It's on page 6. If it's okay, it's a short poem. I'll read this one, then I'll ask you about it. Is that all right?
Yeah, that's great.
So, Salt. Don't salt your food before you taste it, my mother used to say. It might insult the cook, my mother, keen-eyed little chef, forever serving up those heaping dishes of her own life. And I, unthinking, tasteless, salting. Okay. It's a short poem, but it carries for me this dense aura of years of experience. You know, it captures really powerfully a tension between parent and child and the poet's recognition of the ways that, you know, she needs to go her own way, yet also how she's been perhaps, as teens can be, a little insensitive, a little belligerent, labeling herself in the last line, unthinking and tasteless. Can you tell us about this poem? Is it meant to be autobiographical, or are you speaking here to general truisms about the process of maturation?
This one's definitely autobiographical. My dad, actually, when he got the collection, he hadn't seen that one before. And he said he was really taken aback just by how he was like, I can't believe you wrote that. That's amazing. So it's pretty autobiographical. And it's actually kind of a little of a joke because my mom, she passed away a few years ago. She was a really good cook, but she never put enough salt in. I mean, I'm not kidding. Never. Oh my gosh. When we were dating, my husband would come over and she would make dinner and he'd always be like, is there any salt in this? She was such a good cook, but she just didn't like salt. She didn't like salt and sugar. So it's this funny thing where she genuinely like did not put very much salt in her food. But there's also definitely that autobiographical element of we had our differences. It was very hard for me to find a way to write about that because I don't really like to write about things explicitly. I don't enjoy reading those poems, Sharon Olds. I don't enjoy that kind of thing. It makes me uncomfortable. And I think it just puts me off. So I don't like to write that way, but I do want to write things. I mean, the poems are offerings. And since my mom's dead, and I wrote that one after she died, and it's a way of saying I'm sorry. That's what I'm trying to do with that one.
I really love this poem and the poems here that take that family theme. What's great about them, you can have poems that are so personal. They're about nothing other than the poet. Others, though, can be just personal enough that suddenly they touch on something that seems far more shared or universal, right? And these poems here do. So I'm the father of two daughters who are now in their 20s. And nobody is closer to my daughters than my wife is. But also, no one's had more tensions with the daughters than my wife has, right? Yep. Now, you're the mother of young kids, and I don't know if they're boys or girls, but your kids are probably too young to be pulling away from you the way the speaker in this poem is pulling away from her mother, right? They're not that age yet, yeah. I would hope, right?
They're not.
Okay, all right. So this question came here from me just based on my own experience that kind of allowed me to sort of see your poem in a different light. Does writing a poem like this help you prepare yourself for the time when your children will inevitably need to go their own way, or in writing it, do you find yourself almost, if I can put it this way, traumatized in advance by the specter of separation, right? A specter that this poem captures so beautifully in this little crystal of life experience.
I sure hope it's going to help. I don't know if it will. I kind of hope that by writing some of these things down, I will be able to look back at them and remind myself, hey, you knew this was coming. And I do try to think about it regularly, even with my little kids. I try to think about, okay, when they are pushing, because they're not pushing away very hard, but they do occasionally, you get them a new outfit and they say, I don't like that. And you have to choose. Am I going to be offended? Or am I going to say, how about you tell me about what you like, and you can try to reach out and just, so I'm trying to do that. And I'm hoping that I don't think writing the poems themselves is traumatic in advance. I think being a parent who's aware of what the future brings is traumatic. Because you know it's coming, it's coming, and you can't avoid it. You don't want to avoid it. It's a healthy process. You almost want to make your children able to do that, you know, and It's just painful, and you know a lot more about it than I do, but I'm hoping that writing the poems will at least help me be more ready when the time comes, and help me be gentler and more, and not take it personally, not let it become like a personal battle, but help me be able to see, oh, this is an archetypal thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I like that. It's like what you said earlier about how these poems also help prepare you for you mentioned earlier about the religious dimension of poems. These poems help prepare you to sort of live in a different, more like a fuller way, right?
Hopefully, yeah.
And poems can do that. They're not, they can be purely aesthetic objects and not at all didactic. And yet the way that they capture and frame experience can sort of teach us something about what it means to face things that otherwise would be unnamed and therefore less conscious to us.
Yeah. I like that way of putting it. Yeah, because I do think there's a moral element to being an artist. Not that you go out of your way to moralize, but that to make certain kinds of art, you have to be a certain kind of person. So sometimes I'm struck by pieces of art where I think, I can't even imagine being the person who was so morally sensitive that they could make that, that they could write that. Mm-hmm. So that's something that I'm aspiring to, is I want to be the kind of person who can make art that deals gently and graciously with these topics. And that means that's like a day-to-day practice, you know?
Okay, I love that. I'm teaching a class in the fall. In fact, this podcast will be sort of released in the fall when I'm teaching the class.
Nice.
Okay, so I'm thinking in advance. So when people hear this, I'll be teaching the ad class at that time. But what you just said could be really almost like it captures the class idea perfectly, is how do you become the kind of person able to produce and receive certain kinds of poems, right? What does it require not just of us interpretively in terms of our capacity to deal with concepts, but our capacity to receive things sensitively, to be able to register them and to understand their significance. There's a moral component to the very best aesthetic poetry, I find.
Oh, I think so too. There's this one short poem by David Jones, and it's about technology. And there's a line in it where he says, "I have wondered for the automated devices." And that preposition "for," I don't know how you become the person who knows that that's the right word. It's not that he's wondered at them. It's not that he's wondered about them. It's that he has wondered for them. And that's not a decision. You can't make that choice through any amount of reading, through any amount of study. That's a deep capacity to be wounded, which I think is a lot of what morality is that you are willing to suffer. And I just when I read that poem, I'm just struck by it, and I want to be that person who would know to make that choice, you know?
Oh, bravo. That was beautifully illustrated. That's so good, Jane. Thank you so much. I'm going to have my class listen to that right there. So you've got to hear this podcast episode. Pay attention this minute to this minute. That right there, right? That's the class.
Right.
There we are. Yeah. One of my favorite poems in the collection is The Widow of Cana. And it's on page 21, and it takes up the story of the first miracle Jesus performs when he turns water into wine in John chapter 2. Though your poem's speaker is a character from that story 12 years after that biblical episode. This is a longer poem than the ones we've read thus far. It's a narrative poem, and I thought of having us just discuss the first couple stanzas, but I think we probably need to read it in its entirety. So that we can kind of give some context to it. Would you be willing to read it for us? It's just, for readers,
sure.
it's a front and back of a page. It's 2 pages. It's not like 10 pages. It's not that long, but it's longer than about 12 lines, so.
Yeah, sure. My narrative poems generally are longer, so yeah, it makes sense. Sure. Here's The Widow of Cana. "Yes, that was me. That was my miracle, my wedding scene, my tale, though I am scarcely in it. That was it, my life's high point, from which I thought an overflow of joy would stream far down to water arid years. That miracle of such excess, some said it was waste. Who knows? Perhaps it was. The wine unending, splashing on the tables of the feast, and later, as our drinking deepened, the dusty earth herself consumed it. spilled vessels, careless pours. What I would give now for one of those lost drops. It's 12 years ago, that wedding day. And see me now, an infant son, long buried, a husband newly gone. The day is nothing, a story from another life. I see it still, the look he wore when the steward whispered in his ear, the look of shame, the look that over years became his face. And then I felt for the first time the certain special anguish of a wife whose husband is ashamed. Then they went away, and they came back, and there was wine, and much more than we needed, and my love had still his honor. Only later did he tell me of what Mary's son had done. I never saw her after that, though I heard of miracles, too many to recount. Our son fell ill. We hoped that he would come, but he did not. And then it was too late. What kept us from asking him to come? I think we thought we'd had our miracle. I wonder to this day, I wonder why that miracle. Sure, the wine was good, but in other towns, the dead were raised. I heard that he died too, Mary's son. Young, I think. His mother was so young. I wonder if she also wondered why. I have tried to wait in faith. Our fathers in the desert had one sign to keep them through the years. I had one tiny sign, one sign that meant that God had eyes for me, for all the small grapes growing on the hills, for the pebble carried home at dusk, for the first of my son's steps, and for the last, for each loaf of new bread rising on the stones, the little head asleep, a joke beside the fire, an empty seat. There was so much of it, that magic wine, jars and jars of it, like blood pouring from the altar I have never seen, a great river coming down to flood our stricken plain, bring crops and plenty, bearing flowers in the spring. For years, I've fought to make my miracle suffice. I've waited on the scales with my grief and tried to make it balance. But at last, I say, the sign alone won't satisfy. Water into wine is not enough.
Bravo. That's great. This is why I say I love religious poetry, right? I love how your poem turns our attention to one of the signature episodes of the Gospel of John, this wedding feast symbolic of love and union and new beginning. And for Jesus, of course, his public emergence as no mere mortal, revealed ultimately in the book as the Son of God, right? But your poem doesn't stop with those happy symbols of union and emergence, but instead takes up a story, part of the story, long after the fact, right? When the woman here, who's the speaker of this poem, has lost her husband and child, she'd hoped for a healing miracle from Jesus that never came. And in fact, when she says in here, I find this kind of haunting, when you write, I heard that he died too, Mary's son, young, I think, right? So the news resurrection has not reached her, at least not that she's acknowledging here, right? And the poem ends so poignantly. I'm going to repeat this, what you read just a moment ago. For years, I've fought to make my miracle suffice. I've weighed in the scales with my grief and tried to make it balance. But at last, I say, the sign alone won't satisfy. Water into wine is not enough. And it's a beautiful but a haunting poem. Can you tell us about what you see the poem communicating?
Well, I think in a significant way, it's a Eucharist poem, where it's not enough if God just leaves us signs of himself. And obviously the signs are everywhere, And it goes to that final poem in the collection. He gives us all these signs, but at the end of the day, they're not enough because they're passing away and we're passing away. And if he didn't leave us himself, then this is all kind of a joke. and I wanted to communicate that, but I tried to write the poem in a way where the speaker kind of came to the realization of Christ's identity, and it just didn't work that way. It was too didactic. So I thought it became a poem almost of the absence of faith, because she's never been given the opportunity to have faith, but the absence of her faith is almost a faith in itself because she knows what ought to be. And I think that's what's so important, you know. It's that classic thing of like people who've never heard of Jesus, when they die and go and see Jesus, if they see him and they say, oh, you are what I knew was supposed to be, well, I'm not concerned about their salvation. You know what I mean? I know some Christians worry about that, but if everything in their heart and their life has been seeking and knows what ought to be, then when they see it, that's the grace of their salvation. And I wanted that to be her absence of faith to be that kind of absence of faith.
That's great. It reminds me of what you said earlier about how poetry captures, through all that white space, all the things unsaid, right? To sort of speak of faith, which here is kind of unspoken, because what's being expressed is grief and miracles that did not happen, things that should have been, that ought to be, that mm-hmm. were not, and yet that ought suggests that somehow still a possibility, unthinkably so. There's a dramatic irony built into the poem, right? I mean, readers of John's Gospel know the story concludes in the Gospel of John, not with a Jesus who has died, but one who's resurrected, right?
Yeah.
And whose resurrection bears meaning for all humankind, including the speaker of this poem, the widow of Cana, though she herself can't understand that meaning yet, right? In this respect, it's a poem of Holy Saturday, right? The space of waiting between the Friday of Christ's crucifixion, the Sunday of his resurrection. And Holy Saturday lingers with experiences of human suffering. And I guess does that seem right to you, this kind of the Saturday thing for you? And it was the allure for you here, this is a question I'm asking, either or, and it's not the right way to ask it, but is it more theological or more aesthetic? Or is that kind of a distinction without a difference here?
I think it is a distinction, not a difference. I'm kind of obsessed with Holy Saturday. I've written tons of poems about it. And it seems to me such a powerful space, especially looking at what we know about it now, as we believe that the harrowing of hell is going on, and there's great and this like profound work of redemption where Christ is reaching all the way back through time and bringing everything up to this present moment, and the disciples know nothing, they feel nothing, they have no idea. And I love that because it always makes me think, well, we're sitting here, maybe we don't feel anything. I don't have a particularly ecstatic religious life. I don't have profound emotional experiences of God. And I think that's part of why I'm drawn to Holy Saturday, because a lot of my spiritual experiences, I've wondered, well, man, am I missing something? Am I not really religious? Do I not really know God? But I don't think about that anymore, because you don't know what's going on underneath, you know? For all I know, Christ is like in hell drawing things into heaven, and I don't feel it, but it's still happening. So I think that I think the distinction there between theological and aesthetic is more, it's just a lens, it's just a different way to look at it. It's they're the same act, I think.
Yeah, it's great, and they really communicate beautifully in this poem. I mean, I think that you've made a really great, I think, poetic choice to express all these things by way of this character who does not yet have the faith, or certainly the understanding, right, that the readers of the Gospel of John have. In that respect, it's not unlike Mary outside the tomb, right, where she does not see what the reader sees. She sees a gardener, right, at first. So anyway, I think it's a beautiful poem, Jane.
Thank
it's
you.
Great. Now, there are two more poems in the collection I want to discuss. Before we go there, is there one in the collection of special importance to you where you say, the collection exists for this?
The one that it really exists for would probably be that title poem, which is too long to read. But I love that poem, either that one or Part. I actually almost called the collection Part. It was between Part and Pawns.
Mm.
Because I love that word Part. It functions in so many grammatical senses. You can have a part of something, or you can be apart from something, or you can part something. I don't know. It's just a wonderful word. Because it has that sense of wholeness and also division within itself, which I love that.
Yeah, it is a beautiful poem. It's also a longish poem. It's beautiful, though. I'm just looking at part of it. You know, this is like, what, five stanzas in. Years ago, I stood at the altar beside an other, and since then we have tried, oh, how we've tried, to press these fragments together into a whole, all the while knowing it's just a matter of time till death do us part and all our many pieces part. Right? It's great, you know, about what a relationship is. You know, you take fragments, you make a whole. When you make that whole, you don't yet realize all the fragments you really are. The fragments reveal themselves over time. You know, 10 years in, you see the fragments differently, 20 years in, 30 years in. But the whole also expands along with the disclosure of all the many fragments. And then there's this looming specter of death, and what that does then to, unless you die together in some kind of accident, someone goes before the other.
Yeah.
You know, and you're left again in this state of fragmentation.
Before
hopefully a happier union beyond, right?
yeah.
It's a beautiful poem, as is the title poem, Pawns. These are gorgeous poems.
I love that poem, Pawns. It's such a weird poem, but I love it.
That's right. Well, just read to us, so Pawns, and then just read to us the title, right below the epigraph, or below the title.
Yeah, it's Pawns. The last words of Theoderic the Ostrogoth to his magister Cassiodorus.
Right. Yeah. You know, it's Pawns, the familiar, but the exotic is right there underneath it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's a great poem.
Thank you.
Maybe for one of time, we can talk about two that are not quite as lengthy as those. A teaser for people to kind of get this collection and read it. It's beautiful. Two more that this one you dedicate to your mom, and it's on page two. It's titled After the Funeral. And I'd love you to read this poem and to read it, because the poem brings together several images and themes from elsewhere in the collection, right? You dedicate it to your mother. You refer to pawns in the poem. There's candlelight imagery evocative of a sacred space, like in a church and so forth. So can we read it and then we can discuss it for a minute?
Yeah. Do you mind reading it? I actually have not ever been able to read it without crying really hard.
Okay. All right. You know what? Yes, I'd love to read it.
Is that okay? Okay.
Absolutely. It's a beautiful. I didn't want to read the poem that you dedicated, but I will absolutely read it upon your request. So after
Thank
the
you.
Yeah. After the funeral for mom. So that is all life is. A darkening trail. A coin once flipped and idly caught again. A former lover's final correspondence, a ruined cathedral, a probing, blame-filled glance. Is that all life is? A clearance sale? A fire gone out? A broken, useless pen? The silence that always follows a sentence? A scattered rose? A sigh? A squandered chance? Yet, evening reflections on the pond and purple-veiled icons at Lent. Feeble winter sunlight strengthens. Tiny sandals by the door. A house tidied. Beyond the playhouse, a tree planted. The smallest evil mended. In the dark, pinpricks of candles. Mm. It's a beautiful poem. I can see why it would bring you to tears to read. For readers who can't, again, visualize it, they hear it. You can hear how lovely the poem is, but to kind of create a visual picture, it's a poem in three stanzas. And the first two express a sense of angst. The line in the first line of the poem, "So that is all life is," colon, then a series of phrases separated by semicolons. And then in the second stanza begins, "Is that all life is?" Question mark, and then a series of interrogative phrases that follow. But then that third stanza begins, "Yet," with a dash, and then proceeds with a series of images suggestive of hope, fertility, growth, life, and the concluding line, right, "In the dark, pinpricks of candles," seems so different from the poem we discussed earlier, "The Widow of Cana." Do you feel that your collection tries to resolve the tension between, in some ways, those two poems, one that lingers on the suffering of Holy Saturday, and the other, this poem here, "After the Funeral," that already seems to perceive the gleamings of Sunday, not that it's existing in the radiance of Sunday, but the gleamings seem present in the last stanza. Is that a tension that you even try to resolve? Can one resolve that tension finally?
That's a great question. I don't know that you can until we die, but I do think that that's what the whole game is, you know, is trying to bring those 2 days into some sort of conversation with each other, because they're both real. And this is where I think artists do have a different job than theologians, because artists, our job is to look at the world, and if it's there, we need to see it and deal with it. We can't just sweep things. And theologians have a little bit more wiggle room in being able to say, oh, well, all suffering is going to be caught up in Christ and will have meaning. And they can say that. And I believe that's true. But I'm not a theologian, I'm an artist. So I have to deal with the reality that it doesn't feel like that. And I don't know how it's gonna feel, but I do know that the reality is that from every single person on earth, it doesn't feel like Jesus rose from the dead. It doesn't feel like God has made suffering somehow a partner in salvation. Doesn't feel like that. So I think if I did try to resolve it, I don't think I'd be doing my job as an artist, because I don't see the resolution in the world. I see it in places, you know, in little moments and in the lives of the saints and in moments of stillness and peace. But as a general principle, we are living in two realities which do not fit together yet. And I believe they will, but I don't feel and experience it. And that's what I need to be documenting, is that kind of jagged experience. I don't know if that makes sense.
It does make sense to me. That's what I love about art. I mean, look, I'm a religious person too. And I, you know, I'm part of a congregation where I hold various positions, you know, in my religious community, and in a way, I'm, you know, kind of a small T theologian in that respect, you know. But what I love about art is how it captures, it's back to what you said about that poem about the widow in Cana, which is to say, you couldn't quite capture the experience right if you had it as a poem about recognition. It had to be a poem about what was not yet recognized that could evoke a larger recognition, which in a way speaks to our human experience of not feeling the imminence of the resurrection, and yet having a sense that, as you said it earlier, it ought to be, it should be, and it must be. It's there. You can perceive it without it being a reality yet. In that respect, art gives voice to things that are diverse and disparate, and yet they seem to hold together in some kind of delicate balance, that there's a tension there that feels so deeply true to our experience, but also true to the world that God's created.
Yeah, there's a beautiful poem by George Herbert called Prayer. And this poem, After the Funeral, is modeled very closely off of Prayer, because it's also a list poem where Herbert just lists in, you know, 3 to 5 word phrases, character things, ways to describe prayer. And the last one, he goes through this, like, it builds, it's prayer is the sweeping thing. It's a bridge connecting heaven and earth and all these things. And the final phrase is something understood. And it's so understated, but that is what prayer is, you know? And he goes through, he builds and builds and builds, and then just drops you right down to, like, that moment. And I love that poem because I think he gets to, that's what we're all really just trying to do is, oh, I get it. That's what the religious aesthetic journey is, I think. So if you're not familiar with that poem, you should definitely check it out. It's just a masterpiece.
That's great. Yeah. And readers really should look at that. And I should reread it, actually. It's been a while since I looked at it. And that's beautifully evoked, Jane. Thank you very much. Let's conclude with our conversation here with one more poem. But I got to say, before we conclude this, this conversation is why I keep this podcast going. As I've said before, I don't have time to keep doing it, but I keep doing it because I love the conversation so much, right?
This really has been great, yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks for doing it.
Oh, I love it. I'm so grateful. Thank you. This has been great. This last poem, it's a beautiful poem in the collection. It's titled Evening Meditation. It's a brief little poem that captures some very important things. I wonder if you could read this poem for us, then we'll... I got a question for you about it.
Sure. This one I can get through, so yeah.
Okay.
Evening meditation. Such a risk you took and are always taking to show yourself through beauty so pristine, it entices me to look no further than itself, to manifest yourself in a world of such radiance that I, seeing it, am very nearly content without seeing you.
Okay. You spoke a minute ago about the task of an artist is to look, right? You got to look and see what's there. And that implies this risk that God takes, right? That we look and we see what's there, but what God makes is so mesmerizingly beautiful, at times certainly, that we're tempted to stop with the rapturous beauty of things rather than looking to the hidden source of that beauty, right? Rather than looking to its creator. And I guess I'm wondering about how you understand the reason for that risk. And as a poet, and I guess as we talked about this a little bit, but maybe we could put a point on it here, how do you resolve that risk? Because you have to be, as a poet, so attentive to the radiant surfaces of things. And so much of the best poetry really is about attention to sensuous detail, right? It's not about philosophical disquisition. It's not about ideas. It's about what we see. So how do you reconcile that conflict, you know, between the demand to attend to the beauty of the world on the one hand, and on the other hand, the imperative to understand the connection between that beauty and God as its creator? Why aren't services themselves, even the most rapturous ones, enough for you?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I realized, I know there are theologians who talk about this, but I kind of just came to it myself, and then I started discovering these theologians. But I realized at one point that God, you know, for all the virtues that he has one virtue that really surprised me, and in that, like, he's courageous. Mm-hmm. The creation, especially of creatures like Lucifer and us, creatures with free will, it's really a staggeringly brave thing to do. And I remember when I had that realization, this was sometime in college, and I realized that God was willing to take these risks, that meant that somehow that was worth it. There was a payoff there, and it also meant that I needed to learn to take risks, because if that's part of God's character, then that's something that I should be trying to emulate. And so to look at the world and to see the beauty for me becomes, I mean, there isn't another way that God would create. Like, even after the fall, there's still beauty, because that's who God is, you know, and he's sustaining all of this. So it's going to reflect his beauty. And whether I think at the end of the day, it's not my responsibility whether others see God in the beauty, because that's the risk he took, and it's his business to square that. It's my responsibility for myself to see God, to look for God in the beauty, and I want to show him wherever I can and all that, but it's not my job to worry about why he did that, whether it was worth it. All I know is that's what he did, and that sets a standard of make things as beautiful as you can, and don't worry about being misunderstood, because he didn't worry about it. And that's something I love about Christ too, is how often Christ says something and it's mysterious and beautiful and incomprehensible, and then he doesn't clarify. He just puts it out there, and he's fine with running this incredible risk of being misunderstood. And if people walk away from him at that moment, they are profoundly misunderstanding him. They do not get it. But he has confidence that the truth and the true beauty will draw those who are really seeking it, and that they will gain the fuller picture. I don't know how to explain it. It's the classic, you know, predestination versus free will and all that. How did God lay this whole plan out? I don't know. But it's beautiful. And I just love that it almost seems like God can't help but do beautiful things. And as long as he's doing this world, it's going to be beautiful.
I love that. Christ the poet, right? Saying these things, I am the bread of life, right? A great metaphor, right? Yeah. And God's courageousness in creation. That's a beautifully poetic way of capturing a profound theological mystery. Yeah, Jane, a great way to end this conversation, right? With a mysterious thing that will kind of let linger, right? Yeah. This has been fantastic. Thank you so much for your time and your beautiful poetry, and hopefully we'll talk to you again at some point in the future.
This has been really great. Thank you, and God bless you.
Thank you. You too. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the Faith and Imagination Institute, the BYU Humanities Center, and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Starley Pratt. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips and Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.